On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Mumbai's 16 million people are pushing on with their lives. Railway crew personnel are cleaning up the debris. And Indian authorities are working to hunt down the perpetrators of Tuesday's deadly string of coordinated commuter train bombings. And now this, a claim in Kashmir that Al-Qaeda has spread its wings around another angry regional conflict, and a call for India's millions of Muslims to join the fight for Islamic ways. This hour On Point, the bombings in Mumbai and fears over the spread of big jihad. Joining me first today from India's financial capital, Mumbai, with the latest is Kozum Merchant, the Financial Times correspondent in Mumbai. Kozum Merchant, what's the latest there first on the death toll and wounded? Where does that stand?
Hello, good evening. Oh, rather good morning, Tom. The latest death toll is 198 people have died, and some 700 people have been injured and are being treated in hospitals. So that's the immediate toll. Another aspect of the toll is the dent to Bombay's system, the railway system, which was severely damaged but managed to get back running the following morning.
This is India's equivalent of New York City and Wall Street. Is the financial institution of India taking all this in stride?
Well, in fact, it's the equivalent of Hollywood, New York,
mm-hmm.
because it does have this remarkable film industry here as well, which so sits along this financial capital. But yes, that's correct, and I suspect that that actually contributes to why it's being targeted. It's a big city. It's India's financial and commercial hub. It does have another dimension in a very large and successful film industry.
Let me ask you, if I may, Kozum, about this new claim that's just come in, a call in Kashmir from an alleged or self-claiming representative of Al-Qaeda, saying that Al-Qaeda has now set up in Kashmir and appealing to India's nearly 150 Muslims to take up jihad. First of all, what's the view on the authenticity of that, and how are Indian authorities responding?
Well, I'm sure the Indian authorities will take it seriously. There's an acute sensitivity to any kind of claim like that. India has, after all, been confronting this form of terrorism for more than a decade. That call, which was made by someone identifying themselves as from an organization called Jammu and Kashmir Al-Qaeda, was made to a local news agency, and subsequently that agency said that it had no knowledge of the existence of such an organization. So it's difficult to attribute or assess any of the credibility of this call. The caller apparently said that there should be more attacks, such as the one that hit Bombay on Tuesday evening. I'm sure Indian authorities are taking this seriously, just to sort of assess the source of this. But the local agency which received this call simply said it had no knowledge of the existence of such a group.
To be fair, Mumbai, Bombay, has been the target of a lot of attacks, maybe a dozen since 1997, I'm reading here. On the other hand, I read Reuters quoting a retired Indian Army general, now a security analyst, saying that these bombings, 8 bombs on 7 first-class railway cars, commuter cars, were a brilliant piece of precise military organization, which involved required the involvement of 6 or 7 different terrorist cells. He says, this is Ashok Mehta, he says, we have never seen anything like this in India before. He thinks it indicates a link with Al-Qaeda. Are you hearing that kind of talk commonly around Mumbai?
There's much truth to what is being said by the gentleman you quote. Lots of little aspects of this. One, the superb, if you like, the superb way that the bombs were carried out, the planning and the timing. Bombay's rail service is extremely punctual. It may look messy and uncomfortable, but its great virtue is its punctuality. And to organize 7 coordinated bombs that would go off at particular points from their departure and be reasonably confident that they will strike when they're timed to, is it took a lot of planning and a lot of sophistication. That's one aspect of it. Second, all the bombs were placed in first-class compartments. And first-class compartments, these were men-only compartments, are typically occupied by relatively wealthy people, middle-class people, possibly in financial services, and almost certainly Hindus in this city of overwhelmingly Hindu people. So there are very sort of nuanced interpretations of this, and there are very actual interpretations of this. The timers that were found, the timing, the execution of the plan, and also the kind of target audience, the target individuals in the first class compartment.
What about the investigation of the bombings at this point? Where is it targeted? Have there been results yet?
Well, there's not much cause of this stage for the public to draw much confidence from the investigation. The police have said that they've rounded up about 250 people, which doesn't sound very forensic, although they subsequently said that they have detained about 20 to 25 people for leads. There's not much to suggest that the police are getting anywhere near, at least nothing that they have disclosed. There have been plenty of unattributed comments from intelligence officials in Delhi and also from the police in Bombay, certainly sufficient to form a picture of the kind of organization that's behind this. And all fingers are pointing to the Lashkar-e-Taiba, which is a Kashmir-based organization. And that's where everyone's the organization that people are talking about, official as well as the public.
A line to Kashmir and maybe through Kashmir to Al-Qaeda. Qasem Merchant in Mumbai, correspondent there for the Financial Times. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks.
We will hear again from Mumbai in this hour and get a security check from London. But first, joining me in the studio is Adil Najam. He's professor at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, specializes in South Asian affairs. Adil Najam, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And from Bloomington, Indiana, we're joined by Shumit Ganguly. He's a professor of political science at Indiana University. His article in the current issue of Foreign Affairs magazine is titled, "Will Kashmir Stop India's Rise?" He gave us a first view on this yesterday. We're glad to have him back today. Professor Ganguly, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Adil Najam, first to you. Okay, here we have a call in Kashmir and the evidence of a rather sophisticated attack. Do we see something new here? Is this, as our Indian general says, put India now on Al-Qaeda's map?
It could, and if it does, it will be not only big news, it will be very, very, very serious news, both for India and for the world. But I think it may be too early to say. There are a number of signs here which suggest it could be Al-Qaeda, but there are also a number of signs that suggest it might not be. A, India, and particularly Mumbai, has a long history of its own sectarian induced terrorism.
And the Kashmiri groups have targeted it before.
And it's not just Kashmiri. I mean, that's the other thing. It's in the South and Kashmir, sort of the reach may be also extending if it is in fact that, which it might be. But on the Al-Qaeda thing, there might be some indications it may not be. For example, typically in recent attacks, Al-Qaeda actually gives early warning, early threats. It puts a country on the map. It hasn't really with India. It hasn't been saying, India, do this or do that first. Second, Kashmir has not traditionally been an Al-Qaeda issue, and this call seems to be saying both to Al-Qaeda, why don't you make it an issue, rather than saying this is an issue. Third, Al-Qaeda has been actually quite clear in who it is fighting, and it's fighting the West. So even when it attacks in non-Western countries, the targets are clearly Western. In this case, it is not. The first-class compartment of Indian trains is not where your expatriate, you know, bigwigs would be traveling. And finally, it is very sophisticated in execution, but it doesn't have the hallmark of the really big, massive death toll that Al-Qaeda usually goes for.
200 is up in Madrid territory. That's certainly more than in London, But it's not 9/11 in New York City.
Also, it's a 6 million a day train. So it's very, very tragic. But we don't know yet whether it's.
Sumit Ganguly, how do you read this? Of course, Kashmir, cheek by jowl with northern Pakistan. That is where Osama bin Laden is supposedly, by most accounts, hiding out. Is it too much to see the wings of Al Qaeda wrapped around the Kashmir issue and now around India, when we read this statement in Kashmir appealing to Muslims in India to fight for freedom and Islam and choose jihad as their way to achieve freedom and establish Islamic ways, does that ring true to you here? Do you see Al-Qaeda coming to India?
It's certainly within the realm of possibility, though I would be hesitant to say anything with any degree of certainty at this particular stage. One of the things that leads me to believe that it might have the signature of Al-Qaeda is, and this is where I do disagree with my colleague at Tufts, this was a remarkably or carefully orchestrated bombing, the likes of which we have never seen in India. No domestic terrorist group has been able to carry out a bombing of this degree of precision and this degree of complexity, as Khozem Merchant very correctly pointed out. That's the first point. The second is, in recent websites, in recent uploads on websites, Al-Qaeda has alluded to Hindu, Zionist, and Crusader conspiracy.
I've been joined in the studio by Adil Najam at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, from Bloomington, Indiana, by Sumit Ganguly at the University of Indiana there, and right now from London by Rahul Roy Chowdhury. He's Research Fellow for South Asia at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. From 2000 to 2002, he served in the Prime Minister's office in India on the National Security Council Secretariat. He's author of South Asia's Nuclear Security Dilemma. Rahul Roy Chowdhury, thank you very much for being with us. Do you see Al-Qaeda international jihadist fingerprints on the Mumbai bombings or not?
I think it's too early to say. We've seen a report that there has been a group that's claimed responsibility speaking on behalf of Al-Qaeda, but I think that needs to be examined to see where that came from, the credentials, the credibility of that group. But what I'd like to add really is that in the past, I mean, even if you look at the London bombings of July 7th, you have claims, you have attempts at linkage between the London bombers and Al-Qaeda, in terms also of the two earlier British Asian bombers who went to Israel and carried out suicide bombings there, at least one of the, both of them did.
But you've got a claim here now from in Kashmir saying this is Al-Qaeda. Do you not take that seriously?
I wouldn't discount it, but I would sort of look at the evidence. I would wait and see what further developments take place in the forensic examination, in other linkages that the intelligence and security services are looking at. And the way I think what we're seeing is possibly an attempt clearly by Al-Qaeda to move in the front. I mean, the other suspect terrorist groups like the Lashkar-e-Taiba, et cetera, have denied responsibility, and it is this group that's claimed responsibility. My sense is that we need to sort of look at the evidence carefully and clearly before we make that jump and say it is an Al-Qaeda attack. There appears to be, I think, possibly a regional and a sort of national perspective on these attacks rather than simply an international perspective.
Clearly, there's a lot of history here. Kashmir, long a point of contention between India and Pakistan, and a very kind of a high-tension wire between those two. But let me put this to you. Here we're looking at arrests in Canada, the United States, and, of course, the attacks in the U.S., the attacks in the U.K., Europe, Somalia, now India. Is there, in your view, a kind of inevitable coalescing of big jihad here, or is that kind of, you know, fearing ghosts under the bed?
I think that what we're seeing and what we've seen in the past, recent past, have been, as you said, a sort of coalescing. But whether it is coordinated coalescing, whether it is just circumstantial in some ways, that's hard to prove. I mean, can we assume that there is one person or one organization coordinating these global attacks, working on it through various surrogate organizations. I'm wary of that. I mean, what we've seen in the past in India is that there have been terrorist attacks which have taken place beyond Kashmir. In the last few months, we've had terror attacks in Delhi, where over nearly 70 people were killed. We've had terror attacks in Varanasi in northern India, in Bangalore in southern India, in Ayodhya in northern India. So we've seen in the past, and we've seen Bombay also in the past in 2003, that attacks have taken place in the past beyond Kashmir. And it's not, I mean, it's not new that attacks are taking place beyond Kashmir, but whether we can, you know, clearly identify this attack as bearing the marks, the fingerprints of Al-Qaeda, that I think we need further examination and clear and careful examination of the evidence before we come to that conclusion, rather than assume that what this organization has said is true.
Absolutely. We don't want to assume it. We see it just as a single claim, and yet we see the description of the sophistication here, and we can't help feeling this kind of fear. Maybe it's paranoia. Rahul Roy Chowdhury in London, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I want to turn to Jim, calling in from Washington, D.C. Hi, Jim. What do you think? You're on the air.
Hi. Quick question for you. This week's kind of a comment. This week's Economist magazine has a pretty good summary article on Pakistan, and specifically what it mentions in there is that ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Directive,
yes,
Directorate, may have a hand in facilitating the Taliban and Al-Qaeda perpetrating attacks in Kashmir and not providing as much effort to the coalition forces in Afghanistan as we all hoped.
So what do you take from that, Jim?
What do I take from that?
Yeah.
I think the Intelligence Directorate is duplicitous in supporting the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in perpetrating attacks in Kashmir.
So you could have the linkage right there, and maybe even with some complicity by Pakistan intelligence. Jim, thanks for calling. Adil Najam, you're from Pakistan. Pakistan right in the middle of this, two nuclear-armed neighbors. Everybody says there's been effort, yes, but there's still a significant jihadist presence in Pakistan. I'm looking here today at the Afghan defense minister saying they need a five times bigger military than they've got now to keep Afghanistan under control. Everyone looks across the border from the Afghan side. Now we're looking across from the Indian side. What role is Pakistan playing here? Are they a facilitator for Al-Qaeda?
At least certainly at the government level, they wouldn't be, because, in fact, Pakistan government is now a target of these groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba.
But Pakistani intelligence has a history and is part of the government.
It has.
Maybe a rogue part.
Yes, there's a rogue. There might be rogue elements that might be. India-Pakistan peace dialogue, I mean, it isn't as if peace has broken out, but has actually been on a good track. We've recently had...
For the last, 6 months or so, they've been...
Nearly a year.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the big tests here is whether an event like this again sort of scuttles it down.
It hasn't scuttled it yet. They haven't broken off relations.
It hasn't. It's the wording from both the Pakistan Prime Minister and even more from the Indian statements has been very, very careful and in not pointing those fingers. In fact, recent statements from India over the last 6-7 months have suggested that cross-border movements have actually been restricted. Mm. So the Indian government is saying that. So one of the tests here is, and at least the Pakistan spin on this, is that those who are committing this, part of their aim is to scuttle the peace process and to raise the tension between the two countries again. And that may be one other thing.
Sumit Ganguly, India has been moving very visibly deeper into the global economy. Adil Najam was saying earlier that Al-Qaeda's target has been the West. But is it possible that India is now seen, not geographically, but culturally, economically, as increasingly part of the West, and maybe Pakistan lagging in that regard? Does that make India a legitimate global jihad target?
It's difficult to say for any with any degree of certainty, because we are really at the very forefront of this at the moment. This is the first time that anyone claiming to be a representative of Al-Qaeda or somehow connected with Al-Qaeda has specifically alluded to India. And as I also mentioned, that recent jottings on websites have sought to link India with Israel and the United States. But it's still very much in an incipient stage. But there is no question about India's steady integration into the global economy. India is becoming a destination for a number of important foreign firms, most importantly, American firms, and they are highly visible in cities like Bombay, Bangalore, and New Delhi, with the explosion of wealth that has taken place in the last decade, which has been mostly concentrated in urban areas. And the American presence and the Western presence is increasingly palpable and visible in India, thereby making India somewhat more integrated into the global economy. And of course, there is little question in my mind that U.S.-Indian relations have improved in the most dramatic fashion, in a fashion that I would have never imagined in the last 5 years.
So the U.S. presence much greater, the relationship much greater. On the other hand, Sumit Ganguly, Islamic Hindu tension, Muslim Hindu tension in India is by no means a new story, nor is violence around that a new story. So do you see it being turbocharged as India looks to become more globalized, more, if not Western, than modern or cosmopolitan? Does that raise tension here, Professor Ganguly?
No, not really. Hindu-Muslim tensions usually result in unfortunate riots and, on one occasion, tragically, a pogrom in Gujarat about 2 years ago, which was truly grotesque.
This is when hundreds of Muslims were killed. Is this the one you're talking about?
That's exactly right.
In riots, but, yes.
That's right. And the state in Gujarat did little or nothing to stop the people engaged in this form of mayhem. But that is very different from a set of highly orchestrated, sophisticated, complex bombings. That's the distinction I wish to draw. No group in India, to my knowledge, would have the ability to carry this out, because Hindu-Muslim tensions are far more of a spontaneous character. Someone does something uncivil before a mosque, which leads to stone throwing, which then leads to escalated violence, or somebody does something before a temple which irritates the worshippers, who then take it out on their Muslim compatriots, and next thing you know, the entire city is engulfed in violence.
Right.
But that's a very, very different sort of occurrence than the kind of orchestrated attack in the major financial epicenter of India.
So there's the old story contrasted here. You're seeing it with a new story, with this week's story. Vijay's calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Vijay. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I think that the West views the problem of extremists with Islam only in terms of Al-Qaeda, while, you know, that's really far from the ground facts in India. You know, India has a problem of extreme Islam since a long time. And in a tolerant society like India, where, you know, Muslims have been integrated quite well,
yes.
The president of India is a Muslim, the superstars, the musicians, they are Muslims, still you find that extremist Islam continues to cause problems. And what the global community needs to do is to encourage the peaceful among the Muslims to kind of defeat this extremist Islam philosophy.
Vijay, I couldn't agree with you more. I lived in India long ago and was very struck by, you know, apart from the outbursts of domestic violence, sometimes, by and large, this is a terrifically harmonious story of Hindu-Muslim relations there. And yet, let me ask you, Vijay, when you see the more sophisticated kind of attack that Sumit Ganguly is describing here and others, do you have any worry that this internal tension and harmony, both living side by side, are being pulled into a new global conflict, or might be?
Yeah, I would say that I really fear, you know, until now, the conflict in among Muslims and Hindus have been quite isolated from the world, you know. Mm-hmm. The Muslims in India never rioted because of any global reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, Hindu and Muslims, I would say.
You put your finger right on it. Let me put it, if I may, and thank you for your call, Vijay. Let me put it to Adil Najam. Is the world sort of walking in on an old family tension here?
It might be. I think I certainly agree with Vijay's last sentiment that we need to encourage that harmonious. The only part I might, sort of as a student of history, ethnic sectarian tension in India is not restricted to Muslims. Indira Gandhi was killed by a suicide attack from a Sikh.
Sikhs, of course.
Rajiv Gandhi was killed by a suicide attack from a Hindu.
It's a big, right? Multifarious country. There's more than one fault line and more than one kind of harmony.
But here's the thing. Let's assume for a moment that it's not Al-Qaeda. Let's assume for a moment.
Sure.
Al-Qaeda would still like to get the credit for it.
Exactly.
Because we are talking about it in such wonderful ways, you know, sophisticated,
big
high
jihad,
tech,
global,
right?
High tech.
So, if they're sitting wherever they're sitting in their cave, they're saying, okay, keep it coming. On the other hand, those who have, let's assume for a moment it's not Al-Qaeda, whoever has an interest in getting Al-Qaeda interested in this.
Mm-hmm.
Remember how when Microsoft first became big, every new company had to have the word micro at its beginning?
If
you are in the business of setting up anything terrorist, you call it Al-Qaeda off wherever.
Yes, right.
Right?
Right.
In some ways, Iraq was a case in point. Al-Zarqawi brought Al-Qaeda more into Iraq than Al-Qaeda itself might have, because he said, hey, I'm here, I'm going to do this stuff, and you'd better go with me.
You know, you put your finger right on it. We're sitting here, we're looking at India, but we're also kind of calibrating our own internal drama, our own perception of what's going on here, aware that it can be manipulated from many sides. I mean, yes, it can be a kind of boogeyman. We can see it around every corner. On the other hand, there's an interest in enhancing that and trying to establish that.
Very quickly, I think Vijay also put his finger on something else. It's going to sound terrible, but in some ways, Al-Qaeda is now a known factor to us here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So if it's Al-Qaeda, we can understand it. We can explain it to ourselves. We have the vocabulary.
Black and white, kind right? of simple.
Mm-hmm. If we start going into sort of tensions in an area otherwise, whether it's Kashmir, whether it's Hindu-Muslim, whether it's sort of Hindu nationalism versus mm-hmm. Muslim extremism, mm-hmm. those are new things we have to relearn, we have to retool. So Al-Qaeda becomes actually a soothing way of explaining
way
to ourselves.
In the most unsoothing
in
fashion.
The most unsoothing
and yet,
fashion.
It's not as though that some of the details of this are unknown. We've sat here on many occasions on this show and looked at the Kashmir issue, at Hindu nationalism, talked with Salman Rushdie about his childhood there. Shamit Ganguly, here in India you have a country of 1 billion-plus people. Can it be pulled willy-nilly into a drama, a kind of a perception of conflict that doesn't fit it, that's imposed from outside?
No, I really don't think so. I quite firmly disagree with the characterization that was just made.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very easy to be dismissive of the sophistication and the complexity of these bombings. But as someone who has studied this for a very long time,
yes.
and long before it became of interest to the world, I've written on Kashmir at a time when it did not exactly enhance one's career,
yes.
To write on Kashmir, because the world really didn't care about Kashmir. And sectarian violence, by the way, is hardly unique to India.
Mm-hmm,
South Asia, all of South Asia is racked by sectarian violence. And also, I'd like to make a couple of small factual corrections
yes,
with Mr. Najam made. It was not a suicide killer or assassin that killed Indira Gandhi. It was her Sikh bodyguards who were then subsequently shot dead, but they were not suicide bombers or suicide assassins.
But it was sectarian. It was followed by sectarian riots. It was preceded by sectarian tension.
That part I don't dispute, but the factual matter is it was not a suicide attempt.
Yep.
And secondly, it's very disingenuous to characterize the bomber that killed Rajiv Gandhi as Hindu. It had nothing to do with religion. That had everything to do with that individual being Tamil and being a member of the Tamil Tigers, who happened to be Hindu. But the Hindu part is not what's driving them. What's driving them is the systematic discrimination that Tamils have faced in Sri Lanka at the the hands of the Sinhalese majority from the 1950s onwards, so, which is what led a segment of the Tamil population.
But that could also be said for Kashmir, that it's characterizing Kashmir as a Muslim issue. I agree. I did not certainly mean to be disingenuous here, but one could actually say exactly the same about Kashmir Kashmiri militants. That
yes, but I
Muslim
didn't
militants.
Say that Kashmir was a Muslim issue.
But Shamit Ganguly, let me go back then to the main issue we've got on the table then, which is, if you see something so different about this, do you indeed see India as being capable or vulnerable to being dragged into a wider global conflict? Or does it just have too much specific gravity and scale of its own for that to happen?
I hope that India will not get willy-nilly dragged into a global conflict. I hope that the Prime Minister's words, which were extraordinarily restrained, calm, and called indeed for restraint from all communities. I thought it was a remarkable speech, which I watched on television, actually on the web. Thus far, no untoward incidents have been reported. And one hopes that on this occasion, the police in Bombay will be a genuinely neutral force in the event any communal tensions or sectarian tensions arise.
Also, Prime Minister Manmohan Singh saying, no one can make India kneel. No one can come in the path of our progress. The wheels of our economy will move on, among other things. Adil Najam?
Also, I think just to add, to celebrate actually, and I've been just amazed and in awe of the resilience of the Mumbaikers, that the fear one had that this would trigger the type of violence on the streets has actually not happened. Not
so
only
far, fingers crossed, not there.
Right, so far not there. Not only not there, but you see an outpouring from the city itself that spells good.
I want to ask each of you, Adil, you're Muslim. Let me ask you, this Al-Qaeda claim, and, you know, it's one call, we don't know, but yet there's a dynamic here that they may look to profit from. How does the Al-Qaeda, open arms resonate with South Asian Muslims? I know that's many, many millions of people, but is this welcome or does this just sound like trouble to most Muslims?
Well, certainly to Muslims like me, it's big, big trouble, because that's the last characterization you want, Muslim equal Al-Qaeda. But there are certainly those who would want the type of issues like Kashmir to be on the Al-Qaeda map. My sense is the government of Pakistan wouldn't like it. My sense is most Pakistanis wouldn't like it, but there would be the extreme elements like in the Lashkar-e-Taiba itself who might very much welcome it. Also, just to clarify, I'm not discounting the possibility that this is Al-Qaeda. It might very probably be. But what I'm saying is, whether it's Al-Qaeda or for the world, every big terrorist act from now on will be seen through the lens of Al-Qaeda.
Potential.
Where we are in a moment of history.
Shamit Ganguly, what about your sense of Indian Muslims and how they are likely to respond to this Al-Qaeda come hither? Of course, there are nearly 150 million. There'll be many different views, but on balance, is this how does it resonate? Is it attractive? Is it repulsive? Is the jihadist germ widely loose there or not?
For the vast majority of India's Muslims, and as you correctly point out, that they are hardly a small number.
Right.
India has the second largest Muslim community in the world. For the vast majority, I think they would view this kind of violence with utter repugnance and horror, like all of us. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they'd especially care to find out who exactly was responsible for this. I think their initial reaction is going to be one of simply recoiling from this horror, because bear in mind that lots of Muslims, I suspect, were also killed on this train. The commuter train does not discriminate amongst communities and who boards the train in the mornings to go to work. Large numbers of Muslims live and work in Bombay. But the tragedy is, because of the rise of Hindu nationalism in recent years in India, a small, very minuscule segment of the Muslim community has become increasingly radicalized. Mm-hmm. And some of them, tragically, have been implicated in certain very serious acts of violence, including an organization called SIMI,
the students.
In,
mm-hmm.
Yes, the Students' International Movement of India, I believe.
300 some of those arrested in the last couple of days.
Yes, told. I think that's just an initial dragnet to try and see if there are any connections between them. My suspicion is they will have to be released fairly quickly because civil liberties groups and the courts will object to them being detained without evidence. Even if India invokes certain anti-terrorism laws, there are limits to how long people can be incarcerated without trial. So to get back to your central point, a minuscule minority have become radicalized in India, but they really do not constitute yet a significant threat to the Indian state unless proven otherwise.
Let me turn once more to Mumbai, Bombay, and Gautam Adhikari. He's editor of Daily News and Analysis, a Mumbai-based daily newspaper. Mr. Adhikari, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi.
We're talking about the claim of an al-Qaeda connection to the bombings in your city this week. Is that widely known, broadcast in Mumbai at this point, and how are people responding? Is this seen as something bigger than India's own troubles?
Well, we don't know whether it's al-Qaeda, and of course nobody ever knows whether it's al-Qaeda. I think the group that I think Professor Ganguly was mentioning just now, I think that was Sumit Ganguly, so the group called CIMI, they are probably connected with this, and the trail seem to be leading towards them. And they have connections internationally, especially with groups in Pakistan, the Lashkar Toiba, which is connected to the al-Qaeda, but is a group that was spawned within Pakistan. That group is really suspected for these bombings right now, and that's where the leads are going now.
Do you fear India's domestic relations between Hindus and Muslims may be inflamed, may be manipulated by a global movement, or is India just too big to be pushed by something like that, Mr. Adhikari?
Well, at this point of time, the wonderfully heartening thing in Bombay is that despite the bombings that happened yesterday, there is really no sign of that kind of tension. Hindus, I mean, there are lots of Muslims who die, and there are Hindus and Muslims who are just going about life like they do every day, and it's not obvious at all that there's any kind of tension. Shops are open, people are attending office. The banks are open. Our attendance in the newspaper is 100%. So we don't really see, this time around at least, unlike, say, in the 1993 bomb blast which happened in the wake of communal riots that had taken place in Bombay. At that time, there was much more tension. The security was much higher in the days following, and there was a lot of panic, and shops had closed down and shuttered themselves. And people were not going out. This time, life has sprung back to normal remarkably quickly. And there is really, I mean, there are large areas in Bombay which are Muslim-dominated. Life is going on pretty much like it does every day. And Hindus and Muslims are walking together, playing together, eating together. I don't see any sign of any tension right now in Mumbai. Now, whether this will be exploited by anybody further, I don't know, but at least the first any such attempt at exploitation has failed on the first 2 days.
Well, there's a tremendous blessing right there. We hope that continues. We wish your city well in recovering from that blast, and we thank you for joining us today. Gautam Adhikari at Daily News and Analysis, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Let me take a call from Woodbury, Connecticut, and Alex. Alex, you're on the air.
Hi there. Actually, I believe that whatever we say that Al-Qaeda is a creation mostly by media. They try to make it so big. Basically, Al-Qaeda is a creation of West and Muslims conflict. So I don't believe that this related to India's bombing. So if we feel that we say that Al-Qaeda is being blamed or they try to get the credit for that bombing, I don't believe it's right. Basically, whatever is a problem is in conflict in Middle East between Arab and Israelis mostly, and this is the trouble that exists.
Alex, we've got it, and at the same time, we know there is a big Al-Qaeda PR operation that would like to show the biggest face possible, like to claim credit maybe far beyond. We're just trying to sort out exactly that, what's real and what's image here. Thank you for your call. Let me get another from Vivek in Springfield, Massachusetts. Vivek, you're on the air.
Hi. I guess my comment was specifically focused on what effect this would have on Hindu-Muslim relations, and you kind of touched on that when you talked about the 150 million Muslims.
Yes.
I think after the riots in Gujarat in 2002, there have been a lot of efforts to try to split the two communities up. And my question is all this aimed at trying to make Hindus choose whether they are Indian or Muslim first? And see that. And initial reaction after the blast seems to be that everyone seems to be together. And if anything, this is having the opposite effect. But I'd like to have your guest comment on that.
We'll do exactly that. Shimit Ganguly, how about it? This overall tension, Hindu nationalism, Muslim response, heightening, diminishing? How do you read it? So far, so good in Mumbai. But overall, how do you see the trend?
I think that in a very tragic way, the horrible events in Gujarat was a wake-up call to India. And in the wake of that, if you will notice that the BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party, which was the leading member of the coalition that was in power at the time.
The Hindu nationalists, yes.
Yes, they lost the election. That's not the sole reason they lost the election, but certainly on the basis of exit polls, we can ascertain that was one factor. And I want to emphasize this, that it was a factor in their electoral loss. Mm-hmm. And I think the climate in India has changed dramatically under the present government. Whether or not it can be sustained over an extended period of time, particularly when there are events like this, and especially if politicians, unscrupulous politicians, try to link this in some fashion to the Muslim community, one wonders if one can still maintain sectarian peace over an extended period of time. But thus far, I agree with Vivek wholeheartedly that the attempt to promote this kind of sectarian discord has failed miserably. And I continue to hope, and I hope that it will continue to fail miserably.
Let's take another call from Providence, Rhode Island. Punita's on the line. Hi, Punita, you're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to go back to the comment that one of the earlier callers made about the involvement of the Pakistani ISI.
The Pakistani ISI, the intelligence service in Pakistan. I mean, no one has confirmed that, but of course there's speculation.
Yeah, speculation. And just that it is a speculation, although I have read many reputed analysts who seem to agree that the more sophisticated terrorist training camps seem to be in the Pakistani-Afghanistan border, many of them coming out of Pakistan. And I wonder, what would your guests have to say? Is the American situation of, you know, providing these state-of-the-art weapons and millions of dollars of financial aid to Pakistan, are we inadvertently helping some of these terrorist camps, or is our money being put to good use over there?
It's a roundabout. Does it get in the wrong hands? Adil Najam, I mean, there's that, and there's also the instability in Pakistan and the clear strain of jihadism that lives there. You can pick up Punita's specific question, but also does this bleed across the border into India inevitably or not?
There's a lot of speculation there, and I think we should adopt the same care in making these allegations as we do with Al-Qaeda.
Indeed.
Simply because we don't want them to turn true.
But there's history.
Sure, there's history. There's great history, and I think there's real dangers too. I think the other silver lining to this, in relation to this question, to what Shumit was saying earlier, is that India-Pakistan finger-pointing also hasn't started. So maybe we've also reached a higher plateau in India-Pakistan.
Of course, the story's not over yet. There have been Indian government officials saying this looks like it has to have some kind of state support.
Right, but not from the Prime Minister. Again, the Indian Prime Minister's speech was very, very restrained, very, very careful. The Pakistan reaction has been very, very careful. So one of the things to look for is whether these shocks can whether these shocks will tumble the cart, A, in terms of Hindu-Muslim tension within India, but also in terms of regional stability. And it seems to me that right now both India and Pakistan would be very desirous of that not happening. and to keep on the high.
Let us hope that India serves as a firebreak on this and not the opposite. It's been very illuminating, and I want to thank both of you. Adil Najam with me in the studio, professor at Tufts Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. Mr. Najam, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you.
And Shumit Ganguly, professor of political science at Indiana University. Professor Ganguly, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation, download the On Point podcast, and subscribe to our daily newsletter, all at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.